For the week of July 8th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 153, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And back in New York, thank God, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, it's got to be a little bit cooler in New York than it is in Birmingham, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. I was down south visiting my family. Always good to visit my family, but nice to be back home.
Well, hopefully while you were traveling, you were able to keep up on all the entertainment news.
Well, no, that's why I listened to this show.
Well, wait a second. You're actually on the show? So you're supposed to be...
Oh, right.
Well, just in case you weren't able to keep up with some of the news, what I guess I'll be talking about today, and you can just, I guess, sit idly by, Michael, and listen. But if you do care to join in, you can help me discuss which studio just made $1 billion at the box office so far this year.
Now, wow.
Now, speaking of a billion, that's exactly the number Netflix was screaming at the top of their lungs slash press releases last week. Unfortunately, a billion is probably not a number the music industry will have to count to, because sales are, while they're up so far this year, they're not up that much. We'll explain. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. On Inside Baseball, we will explain why worldwide anti-piracy legislation took a big hit last week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office. And you know what? I could not come up with like a quick little like zinger about slinging the box office or slinging.
I'm glad you didn't.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, we'll be talking about the worldwide box office as always. And the number one movie around the world is The Amazing Spider-Man, which grossed $194 million worldwide this weekend. To date, it has grossed $342 million total around the world. I have seen these numbers sliced and diced every way to Sunday. It was a July 4th release. It opened on Monday night, Tuesday morning. They compared it to the other Spider-Man movies, to Transformers, which also opened on July 4th weekend in a similar pat. On and on and on. None of it matters. Take a deep breath. Step back. Over like 10 days, Spider-Man has grossed $342 million worldwide. It's a very good start. Let's see where we are in a month. But chances are we're going to see more Spider-Man. Number two around the world is Ice Age Continental Drift. The smash hit animated franchise that's much bigger overseas than it is in North America. It has grossed $80 million worldwide last weekend. It's at just under $200 million, and it opens in the U.S. on July 13th. And number three around the world is Ted, which has turned out to be the biggest hit of the summer. It's the Seth MacFarlane comedy about a foul-mouthed teddy bear, and the Australians love foul-mouthed teddy bears. This movie was a big hit in that country. The per-screen average was off the charts. It was almost $60,000. Per screen in Australia. They like their comedy raw and up in your face. It grossed $47 million worldwide. That's basically North America and Australia. Hello, Australia. It is at $141 million and counting.
I think that the Australians really just like foul mouth stuffed or, you know, talking stuffed things. Because if you look at like Wilfred is from Australia originally. It's now on the FX network and stars Elijah Wood, but it's Elijah Wood talking to a man dressed in a shaggy dog costume, and he's the only one that can see the shaggy dog as a man in a costume. Everybody else sees it as a dog.
Yes, well, you know, droll and understated is not the general impression one gets from Australian comedy. From, you know, we've been enjoying their comedy ever since Crocodile Dundee, and I'm sure before that and after that, TV shows, movies, and all that. They like it. They like it bold and in your face.
Well, kind of like, you know, Mel Gibson being their, you know, probably their most successful and well-known foul-mouthed comedian.
At number four around the world is Brave by Pixar, a fine animated film. I finally caught up with it. It's not one of their classics, but it's a good, solid movie. It grossed $24 million worldwide. It's at $211 million and counting. It is a long way to go, a lot of countries to open up in. At number five is a North American debut. Oliver Stone's violent new drama, Savages, opened to $16 million. I do recommend the books, but I haven't seen the film. I'm looking forward to it. At number six around the world is Magic Mike, the movie about male strippers by Steven Soderbergh. It grossed $15 million worldwide. It's at $72 million and counting.
Now,
That's a lot of bachelorette parties.
Yes, that is a lot of bachelorette parties.
A lot of singles.
good point. Now, how is your lawsuit coming against Mr. Soderbergh for stealing your life story?
No. My lawsuit is against the Sugar Hill Gang because I'm often known as Wonder Mike. And so I've been, you know, suing the guys who created the Sugar Hill Gang rap, but
okay.
Rapper's Delight. But, you know, it's a wholly different issue. You know, we're in the courts. I'm not supposed to talk about it. At number seven around the world is Madagascar 3, another hit animated franchise. It's grossed $14 million this weekend. It's at $450 million and counting. At number eight, another debut. This is one of my bete noirs dealing with people who talk about concert films. Katy Perry, Part of Me, essentially a 3D release, though it is available a little bit in 2D. It opened to $12 million worldwide. It has grossed $14 million and counting because it had some early sneak or release in some other country. It's a film that people said, oh, it didn't do nearly as well as, you know, Hannah Montana and Justin Bieber and Michael Jackson. No, that's true. But in its opening weekend, it is already the seventh highest grossing concert film of all time in North America. Bigger than U2, The Rolling Stones, Talking Heads, Neil Young, NSYNC, and a lot of other artists. Concert films do not gross that much money. Is it a profitable film? I don't know. I'm not sure what they spent on the budget. That will determine that. But unless they're idiots, they didn't spend more than $10 million because concert films don't make a lot of money. Katy Perry, Part of Me, is already in the top 10 concert grossing films of all time in North America.
Well, where did
so
it open?
Call
did
this
it open
a flop or, you know, somehow underperforming is just idiotic.
Well, a couple of points. One, where did it open? Did it open all over the world or just in
North America? No. It opened in North America and I think Australia or okay. It had just a $2 million overseas somewhere.
Okay, well, now, secondly, you mentioned U2 in that long list of...
Yes, they have two films in the top 10, U2 3D and U2 Rattle and Hum, a film I actually quite like. You know, and they gross like $8 million, $9 million each. So they're, you know, they're in the top 10 with two of their films.
And Rattle and Hum was 1988-89.
Oh, for God's sakes, you and your inflation... thing.
That's all I'm saying is that prices go up.
You know what? The point is that if you go below the top 10... you barely have a concert film that grossed more than $2 million. So I don't care what inflation rate you're looking at. It's not, you know, they're not players. Almost no concert films gross more than $1 or $2 million. Virtually none. You have to be in the top 13 of all time in order to gross more than $2 million. This is not an issue of inflation and, you know, comparing movies from 80 years ago to today. No, this is a case that concert films don't make money. So to compare the outliers, which are Justin Bieber, which is the highest grossing film in North America, Michael Jackson, which is just below it. Justin Bieber grossed $73 million, Michael Jackson $72 million, and then right below that, Hannah Montana around in the $60 million range, $60 to $70 million range. Those are huge outliers. They are way not the norm.
So we shouldn't count any of Al Jolson's big hits in there.
I don't believe he has a concert film.
I know, but, you know, I was hoping none of our audience members would actually know that.
Keep an eye open for One Direction because their concert film comes out in November. They're the latest boy band trying to strike it quick while the iron is hot. We'll see how they do with, you know, You Don't Know You're Beautiful. At number nine around the world is another interesting film. It's called Bal Bachchan. It grossed $11 million worldwide and in its debut. It's a Bollywood comedy in Hindi by director Rohit Shetty. We all love his work. Why are we hearing about this movie? We're hearing about this movie because it's from Fox. Fox is a co-producer on this film with Star Studio, their label. They picked up worldwide rights to this movie for $19 million or just under $19 million. I'm sure there are movies that open in India all the time that gross $5 million, $8 million, $9 million, $10 million. And we don't hear about them because we don't have access to that information. And those studios don't bother to send out press releases to North America. But in this case, Fox is an American studio. They want to get attention for their movie. They're already plugged into all the people who, you know, post movie information. So they got the word out that Bal Bachchan grossed $11 million worldwide in its debut. If we had better info on India, I'm sure we'd be including more Indian films, more Bollywood films in our rundown of worldwide box office. We grab all the information we can, but we don't always have access to the information for every big country around the globe.
You know, I actually like to counter you on that. You know, Bal Bachchan, which is the movie we're discussing now.
Hilarious comedy.
Because it's being released by Fox, it's being released wide. Now, a lot of the Bollywood films that are released in India and elsewhere, they are released slowly and on a platform. So they'll make like, you know, 200 prints and they'll bicycle them all over the world, you know, kind of.
Well, a bicycle seems an odd way to do it. Is that still true?
Well, yeah, actually, they call them...
I thought piracy would be a big problem, that they'd be moving towards more of a wide-release format.
They definitely are, as we'll discuss in a moment.
India is pretty well, you know, multiplexed, isn't it?
Well, it's getting multiplexed, and as we'll discuss in a moment, I mean, you know, well, I guess maybe we can discuss it now. The Amazing Spider-Man opened in India over the weekend, and it was the highest opening for a Hollywood release ever. It made, I think, what was it, $6 million or 340 million rupees. Of course, released by Sony Pictures India. And it had 1,200 prints made in India. And those are mostly film prints. And that those included Hindi, Telugu, and Tamil prints. And of course, the film.
Don't they include the
English
subtitles on all three, on all the prints?
I would assume so, but I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe
when I've seen films in Asia or other countries, it tends to, there's like three levels of subtitles, sometimes covering half the screen.
Yeah. Well, you know, the film, of course, stars Irfan Khan from Slumdog Millionaire. So it does star a hometown hero.
He has a small cameo in The Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, when I kind of read that, I thought, well, that's, you know, what, he's in like 2.5 minutes of a 2-hour, 10-minute movie. That's not much.
Mm-hmm. But it's nice to see. It's a bit of a draw.
Yes. But, you know, we're seeing $10 million plus opening weekend grosses in places like Russia and Mexico and China almost all the time now.
Yeah, places that you never heard about before are suddenly producing big grosses, which makes sense given their population. I think perhaps if there weren't opening weekend figures for films that open in Bollywood, we don't get end of the year information for movies that turned out to be big hits and grossed. That might make the top grossing movies of the year list. They might have grossed $10, $15, $20, $30 million, but we never hear about them because those countries aren't actively trying to promote their movies to the North American press. But I think the more the Hollywood studios are involved, the more information we'll get and the more prominence these movies will receive, not to mention the fact that, you know, it opened wide, so it deserves to be on the list. At number 10 around the world is a movie that won't open overseas, Tyler Perry's newest Madea film, Tyler Perry's Madea's Witness Protection. I have to say, I looked at the trailer and I kind of laughed. It grossed $10 million worldwide. It's at $45 million and counting. And the person doing all the counting, Tyler Perry. At number 11 around the world, Snow White and the Huntsman, $10 million worldwide. It's at $350 million and counting. At number 12, a big flop finally, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. It grossed $7 million worldwide. It's at $59 million and counting. At number 13, Moonrise Kingdom, the Wes Anderson film, which continues to chug along. This is sort of a classic limited release movie that's sort of platformed out, and they're going to have it in theaters for months and months, I think. It grossed $4.6 million worldwide. It has a lot of territory still to go. It has $29 million worldwide to date. At number 14 is Prometheus, another $4 million. That's just under $300 million and counting. And at number 15, I know it has some overseas figures, but I couldn't find any. All I have are North American figures for the Woody Allen film To Rome with Love. It grossed $3.5 million. It's at about $17 million worldwide and counting.
Well, now, I was surprised that you didn't talk about The Amazing Spider-Man a little bit more and how those numbers were being sliced and diced. And there was one number in particular that I'm pretty sure you're interested in.
What's that?
The 3D percentage, the percentage of box office that was attributed to 3D screenings.
That's right. I thought this was another very, very telling statistic. If you're going to go see a movie in 3D, it's going to be a movie like Spider-Man. And its 3D grosses on opening weekend were only 44% of the total. So 56% of the ticket sales were for 2D. Or the money. I'm never quite sure if they mean 56% of the money made or 56% of ticket sales. Do you know what I'm... Do you know what that would be?
Yes, that's a very good question. And
it's probably money made, right? Which
yes,
means
it
even
is.
More tickets were sold because, you know, 2D prices are lower, which means if 44% of the gross was for 3D, that means more like 60-65% of ticket sales were for 2D viewings of that movie.
Well, actually, I'm sure that somebody would counter you, like the studio themselves, and probably say, well, that...
Well, it's not possible. If 44% of the gross is for 3D money taken by 3D, since those ticket prices are higher, that means they're even less than 44% of ticket sales.
But what about
it's
the 10%?
It's not possible. They have to be less.
Well, what about the 10% from IMAX 3D screenings?
Those count too. What do you mean?
So do those count in the 3D?
Oh, of course. They're okay. 3D.
So then technically that's 34%
for 3D. There's
no IMAX
3D screening.
So then that's 34% for 3D screenings then. Regular 3D screenings.
So you mean of ticket sales is your estimate?
Well, yes. Yeah. I mean, when you look at
it. So you're saying 2/3 of ticket sales were probably for 2D. And again, they are setting aside a significant majority of their screens for 3D. And it's always the biggest screens in the theater, the best screens, the most, you know, the most packed with seats. So they can't keep doing that.
And I'd like to actually counter that, and not because I'm trying to be
countering a lot today.
Well, I'm not trying to be contrarian here since we're talking.
I wish you would.
But here's the thing, you know, so in the movie theater down the street from me, I went to see The Amazing Spider-Man, and to be honest, I had seen most of the interesting 3D work already. And, you know, the timing...
I saw it in 2D.
Yeah, and frankly, the timing for me was better to see it in 2D. But as I'm walking up to the theater, I see The Amazing Spider-Man on the marquee. Underneath, it says 2D and 3D. Next to it on the marquee is Katy Perry, Part of Me. And then underneath that, 2D and 3D. And I looked at the show times, and the same screen was used for both the 2D and 3D screenings. They basically flip-flop. They, you know, what the 3D screening went first, then it was the 2D screening, then it was
for Katy Perry or for Spider-Man?
For both. For both.
You're
so they were using
me.
The same screen.
That's not possible. You know all the problems with that.
Well, here's the thing. The problems are, of course, that you need to have 3D equipment for 3D screenings.
And it can take, like, literally an hour to switch back and forth.
Not really. Not when you are using the same projector and all you're doing is pushing the Z screen out of the way. The polarizing filter out of the way of the projector. That takes all of about 10 seconds, and that's exactly what they're doing. Here's the problem.
But,
so the projector's not the problem. The problem is that when I was watching the Amazing Spider-Man, I looked at the colors, and I said, you know, all the whites look just a tad off. Everything looked just a tiny little fraction off color-wise. The whites looked a little gray. It looked a little murky to a trained eye. Mind you, what they were doing was projecting in the same auditorium that 2.5 hours later they were going to be projecting the same film in 3D, which means they were projecting it, in this particular case, onto a silver screen. And literally the screen is silver. It has, you know, it's not just painted silver, it's silver.
So those screens are only good for 3D?
Those screens are good for 3D and 2D, but with 2D, the color's off a bit. In fact, so much...
Well, then they're not good for 2D.
Well,
the color's off.
I would agree, but...
they're not good at all.
The idea with the silver screen is that, of course, it gives you some gain, some improved brightness. The color is off just enough that in France, by 2017, they have actually banned the use of silver screens.
So you're just detailing a lot more problems. Are you saying most theaters around the country flip back? That seems a real pain.
No.
In the
I'm
neck.
Just saying.
Why would you do that?
I'm just saying the theater down the street from
me. Okay, but in general, don't they like? Isn't usually the biggest theater in the multiplex the one that they have fitted for 3D, and that's where they want it because they're hoping to get as many ticket sales and cram as many people in for the highest ticket price. So they set aside their biggest elaborate screening room for the big new release of the week in 3D, whether it's the Avengers or Spider-Man or whatever.
Well, I think that would have been more true a couple of years ago, but it certainly, I think, is predominantly true today.
Okay, and also it seems like switching back and forth just creates so many problems.
I don't know if everybody's doing that, but I will tell
you
that...
Why would you want to switch back and forth between two? It makes no sense. It doesn't help anything. It doesn't give you more screenings of the movie. Like, why would you not have...
Well, because if you know that certain people are going to actually seek out a 2D screening, then you would screen it in 2D. And I think it's very interesting that you texted me over the weekend and said, well, how many 3D screens were there? Because we were trying to figure out, like...
We knew there were about 4,000 screens showing Spider-Man.
Yeah, and, just over, 4318 or something like that. And I looked and looked. I probably spent 2 hours looking and searching. And I'm sure if I had called up RentTrack and pulled up RentTrack, I would have been able to figure it out. But there were no indicators as to how many screens were in 3D. And I think a large part of that is because the screens were in both 2D and 3D. So it was almost impossible to tell you how many screens there were in 3D because they were all in 3D, or not all, but a majority of them were in 3D, but mostly 2D.
Well, anyway, we know this exhibitors will expand and contract the screen count during the weekend if they find, you know, theaters are empty and another movie is jam-packed. They'll obviously add more screens and thing. But when I'm walking through multiplexes, I don't see, like, you know, Spider-Man 3D, at 2:15 and then at 5 something that's a 2D screen. I've not noticed that at all. That seems odd to me. I can't understand the point of that. There seems no advantage to it. It only creates problems with having to switch back and forth on the lens. You know, they're going to have 4, 5, 6 screens devoted to Spider-Man. Why you'd mix up the 2D and 3D is beyond me. It just doesn't, I don't understand why that would be even remotely helpful to anybody.
Well, again, remember, I was seeing it at a Regal Cineplex or a Regal Multiplex, which means they weren't switching the lens at all other than pushing the polarizing filter out of the way.
Well, that's a whole different issue. One other question I have is about international grosses. In North America, the rule of thumb is that a studio gets about half of the domestic gross back and the exhibitors keep the other half. But then I saw somebody talking about overseas grosses, and they were claiming, hey, you know, when a studio starts boasting about overseas grosses, that means they're, you know, not doing as great because they have to claim overseas grosses as a part of the movie's profitability. I'm like, what are you talking about? But their argument was that they don't collect half of the grosses from overseas because it's a lot harder to collect, a lot harder to nail down, a lot harder to do accounting. There's so many different countries and rules and laws and, you know, standards and practices. And so their claim is that, I don't know, whether they studios might only get a third or, you know, 40% of overseas grosses coming back to them, something like that. Are you familiar with this argument or this problem?
Oh, absolutely. It's a very common argument and one that's both true and not so true. I think, you know, in France, it's really easy to tell how much a movie has made because the government actually keeps track of ticket sales. Why do they do that? For tax purposes. The same thing is true in Hungary. As a matter of fact, there are two receipts that are given. One is for the tax man, one is for the customer. So in those countries, it's very easy to track how much is made. Now, China and Russia, on the other hand, I think it's been pretty widely known that it's, you know, $1 for the studio, $1 for the exhibitor, and then it's another dollar for the studio and $2 for the studio, you know, for the exhibitor. So
they're all getting better.
They're getting better because, of course, everything is becoming far more electronic. But it's very difficult to track everything in certain countries as well.
Well, so when we're looking at profitability of a film and we look at its worldwide gross, we can't assume that the studio has got about half of that because, you know, the overseas is a little trickier. It's more of a black hole.
Well, that's where I was headed at. You know, the other thing is that the deals in each country are different and sometimes have to be struck differently due to the local laws. For instance, in the UK, you cannot strike a booking contract for more than a week. So if you know a movie's not doing well, all of a sudden, the next week, the second week in release, the exhibitor can cut a much better deal.
And so when we look at Disney, and they are the studio we referenced at the top of the show, they are the first studio to pass the $1 billion box office mark. That's only in domestic gross.
Yes, correct.
Oh, I thought that was worldwide.
No,
wow.
That's domestic only. Okay. And of course, they were helped a great deal by a little film that was made that they put some money behind called The Avengers.
Yeah, that helped a little bit. And that grossed $611 million so far in North America. And of course, we can feel pretty confident that they got about $300 million of that back.
Yes, correct. Especially
as far as the other $900 million, well, who knows?
Right. And I wouldn't doubt that on a film like that, they're probably doing an aggregate of about like 55-60%. So they're getting a little bit more than 50% on that particular film because they know that exhibitors will pay it because exhibitors know, hey, you know what? If I show this film, instead of having, you know, 150 people in my 225-seat house, I'm going to have 200 people in it for the first week.
I thought there wasn't much more wiggle room these days. I thought it was fairly that those bargaining back and forth movie to movie wasn't going on so much anymore.
Oh, no, it definitely goes on. It absolutely goes on because, yeah, it might be 55-60% for that. But then for some other Disney movie, it'll be 48-45%.
And, of course, Robert Downey Jr. has his cut as well.
That's right. And that's pretty much what made 611. So carry the one. They owe him $50 million. And actually, this is a money loser. They should.
Martin, the Avengers. They better not make any others. So one actor who is not a first dollar gross participant is probably Ernest Borgnine, who died this week.
That's right. Unfortunately, at the age of 95.
Well, unfortunately, he's 95 years old. For God's sake.
Yeah. Okay.
I wouldn't say it's unfortunate. It's, you know, it's what happens.
Now, were you a big Ernest Borgnine fan?
No, I've never really thought of him he's not an actor I've particularly been fond of or followed, but, you know, when you look at the films he's been a lot of very good movies. Obviously, Marty is his big role. He won the Oscar and it won Best Picture, the lowest grossing film to ever win Best Picture for quite a long time, if not still. He was in, he beat up Frank Sinatra, beat him to death in From Here to Eternity. He was in The Wild Bunch, one of the best Westerns of all time, The Dirty Dozen. So he has a lot of good movies and to his credit.
Well, now, would Marty still be the lowest grossing Best Picture winner of all time if adjusted for inflation? Just kidding.
It may not be, but it's still probably pretty close because I think it's what's the bomb movie? Forgive me.
You know, the one with the Jeremy Renner, the Hurt Locker.
Thank you, the Hurt Locker. I think perhaps we'd have to look, but even adjusted for inflation, Marty might still be the lowest grossing. Though it gets really tricky because in the 30s and 40s, the grosses were quite low, but we'd have to see.
Well, you know, you say he started in a couple of good movies. Look, since 1951, he started in 115 movies, and they included movies like The Flight of the Phoenix,
Not a bad movie.
And The Wild Bunch, as you mentioned. Willard, The Poseidon Adventure. Of course, he was also known for starring in a few sitcoms, specifically McHale's Navy in the 60s. And
yeah, that's probably why I have a negative impression of Ernest Borgnine, because it's a pretty dumb, low-rent comedy.
Right. And you know, he was also a voice on SpongeBob SquarePants, believe it or not.
No, he was a mermaid. Wasn't he? He was like Mermaid Man, a retired superhero. And that's, I think, a terrific show. I wrote about it really early on, so I've always felt a certain kinship to that series. I love SpongeBob. And then looking over his obituary, he was married to Ethel Merman, of all things, for about 6 weeks. He was married 5 times overall, but his last wife, I think he married in the early 70s. So they were together for a good 40 years. So, you know, very nice to see.
Well, you know,
but didn't you know Ernest Borgnine? Didn't you bump into him? Didn't you have a run in with him?
Well, you make that sound like somehow I was beat to death by him. but no, you know, in the 90s, Jonathan Silverman, who is probably best known for Weekend at Bernie's, he was in a short-lived sitcom. I think it lasted 2 years, maybe three, called The Single Guy. And Ernest Borgnine played the
doorman.
The doorman. That's right. Yes. And it was shot here in Los Angeles. And I was working for Jonathan Silverman's agent at the time over at CAA. And so on Fridays, you know, we would work so hard all week, you know, 16, 17 hour days. On Fridays, for some reason, I was continuously invited to the tapings of this show, The Single Guy. And afterwards, everybody would be on the set and I'd be, you know, sitting on the set with everybody. And Ernest Borgnine was there all the time. And I thought, oh, wow, look, there's a legendary actor sitting over there. And he never talked to anybody. He just sat in the corner smiling and just happy to be there.
That's sweet.
And I just thought, I would go over and talk to him and he'd, you know, have very little to say. And I just thought, you know, what are you doing on this show?
He's just a simple guy having fun. I loved his quote in the New York Times in their obituary. They had a quote from a 1973 interview where they asked him about his acting method. He's like, and his quote was, "No Stanislavski. I don't chart out the life issues of the people I play. If I did, I'd be in trouble. I work with my heart and my head, and naturally, emotions follow." So he said sometimes he prayed or just reflected on the character appropriate thoughts. And then he said, "If none of that works, I think to myself of the money I'm making."
And that's, you know, in the very short relationship I had with him of like maybe a couple meetings, that is his sense of humor.
Yeah. So that's an old school Hollywood guy. You know what? They're paying me. I'll find my motivation right there.
You need me to stand in the corner during the after party? I don't care. But you know, I wonder if you could see McHale's Navy or even the Single Guy, or you could probably find most of Borgnine's movies on Netflix.
That's true.
We mentioned at the top of the show, Netflix had a big announcement last week.
What was it last week? Oh, you mean during this week? I thought you meant previously. I got confused. Yes, they have 1 billion hours of viewing.
Yes. And I have to say, Michael, look, put the Netflix down. You can't, yeah. You know, you can't watch them all in 1 month, okay?
Yeah, no, this is for the month of June.
That's right.
And they have calculated that 1 billion hours of viewing were going on. So that's, you know, and McHale's Navy, by the way, is available on Netflix.
So that's what the pauses were for. You were actually looking up to see.
Yes, I wanted to know if it was available on Netflix.
Okay.
So this means that if they measure, I'm not sure how many people are signed up for them right now, but it's an average of about 80 minutes per day last month on Netflix.
Yeah, I don't get
that. And that means they're bigger than any cable network.
That's right, because people aren't watching cable networks for 80 minutes a day. In fact, they could be possibly bigger than some broadcast networks. According to Richard Greenfield, the BTIG analyst that we've mentioned quite frequently on this show.
I mean, that doesn't make sense because, I guess it's per day, but I guess because there are 700 channels, that's why it just averages out to less than 80 minutes per day. Because Netflix is one thing with 8 gazillion opportunities of things to watch, whereas ESPN, you might watch once every 2 or 3 days for, you know, 3 hours, but then you're watching something. People watch a lot of television, so... you know, frankly, 80 minutes a day just doesn't sound like that much to me.
Yeah. Well, you know,
I guess because of the number of viewers as well, the number of people that they have logging in and streaming and doing all that.
Right. And that explains why your internet is so slow.
Yeah. Does that include DVDs or is this pure streaming? I assume it includes DVDs as well, right?
I don't know.
It must include both. Why wouldn't it?
I don't know. I'm going to actually try and figure that out.
I think it would be bizarre if it didn't. But they're, you know, they're very exciting. And Reed Hastings, is he the head of Netflix?
He is the CEO and founder of Netflix, yes.
That's right. And he said, congratulations to his team and everybody that they're doing. We've exceeded $1 billion for the first time ever. Quote, when House of Cards, the miniseries starring Kevin Spacey, and Arrested Development debut, we'll blow those records away. And he's right. Those are going to be huge draws for Netflix.
And I love the way he congratulated the head of content development and content over there at Netflix. He said, keep going, Ted. And he was referring to Ted Sarandos, the head of content. He said, keep going, Ted. We need even more. It's like,
give me the money.
Yeah. Congratulations. Now get back to work. It's. Well, and I wonder if maybe Jerry Seinfeld one day might have a show on Netflix.
Is Seinfeld not available on there?
Well,
oh,
no.
Mean a new show?
I mean, yeah, maybe he'll give up NBC and head on over to Netflix and just do an internet show.
Well, for years he's been doing funny work on commercials with American Express and odd little things. I mean, he had that reality show about comedians giving advice to people who were in relationships or marriages that didn't last very long.
I blocked that whole.
Yeah, but he's doing odd, quirky little stuff, and I think we have another example of that coming up.
Yeah, I mean, I guess over the past week he released a trailer. It's about a minute long, called "Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee." Now, the odd thing is, now we all know Jerry Seinfeld is a big car collector. He's got, you know, a couple dozen cars and classic cars. I mean,
he has a building. He bought a brownstone and converted it into a parking lot. That's when you have too much money, when the building next to his home has been converted into a parking garage for all his cars in New York City. It's not even like Leno, where you're like in L.A., you've got room. It's New York City. That's how rich he is.
Yes. Well, and I wonder, do you think that, they're what, like all Toyota Camrys and Toyota Celicas? No, they're all classic cars. And the teaser trailer doesn't really go into much detail. It looks like.
What is this? What are we talking about?
A little bit like a new web video series. It's going to feature Jerry Seinfeld apparently driving around maybe in one of his cars. I don't know whether they're his. It looks like they're his. And he's driving around with people like Larry David and Ricky Gervais and Colin Quinn and Alec Baldwin. And apparently they go get coffee. The show will appear on Crackle, which is a Hulu type service run by Sony. And guess who produced his hit sitcom for NBC? Sony.
Well, Castle Rock.
Well, yes, but it was Sony that really was the production company behind that.
Well, no, Castle Rock was alone and independent when it began. That's what saved Castle Rock, you know, when Harry Met Sally and then Seinfeld. Castle Rock was not a Sony arm at that time. They were going to go out of business, and then Harry Met Sally had a big opening weekend.
Got it. Okay.
So Sony had picked it up at some point or was a distributor, but Castle Rock are the people who made it happen.
Okay. Well, needless to say, somehow Seinfeld and Sony have a relationship, and it continues here with this Crackle thing. And the publicist...
So is it Crackle.com? I've never heard of it.
Yeah, I believe it is Crackle.com, and I've only heard of it in passing. I'd been there a couple times. It has a lot of Sony movies.
Why would he do it there?
I'm sure.
Is it also available on the website that he set up?
Which is, I think, I don't
know. It's called comediansandcarsgettingcoffee.com.
I think it probably is, yes.
Yeah. And I think you can just go to the comediansandcarsgettingcoffee.com, bookmark that. You can see the video. And I imagine, I don't know, but I imagine that the episodes will be posted there. I assume they're probably like 5-minute shorts where he and comedians riff on a topic of the day while they go get coffee.
Right. Well, and
but I mean, the cars were beautiful. There was this beautiful Volkswagen Bug or Beetle that looked really cool. And, there's like you saw 8 or 10 cars in this 1-minute trailer. But the thing that really shocks me about this, and I'm a guy who's been trying to go online and reserve website names for businesses, coming up with every bizarre name you can think of. And yet I'm stunned that comediansandcarsgettingcoffee.com wasn't taken. If anybody's ever tried to find a domain name that was available for a business they were starting, they know what I'm talking about. Everything is taken.
Well,
so.
Wait a second. You're assuming it wasn't taken and that he, it could have been taken and he just saw that it was taken and decided
and said,
to
hey,
pay.
You want $100 million? Sure.
Yeah, exactly. I happen to have one lying around. I think it's in one of my cars in the brownstone that I purchased next door to my brownstone for all of my cars.
It may be.
Now, what I love is the fact that, well, one, the publicists who, everybody was trying to figure out what is this show about. So all the
comedians.
In cars.
Driving around in a car, getting coffee.
Right, but
they're comedians. They're making jokes and they drink coffee. What's to figure out?
Well, wait, just hear me out here. The publicist, both Jerry Seinfeld and I guess Crackle's publicist, said, we're just going to let the content speak for itself. The funny thing about that is nobody speaks in the content. There's
well,
no
the trailer, yeah.
Yeah,
in the show itself, of course, it will.
Yes, exactly.
So when does it debut?
It debuts, I think, what, July 19th at 9 p.m.
Well, that's the Seinfeld time.
Right, and I thought, how weird is that?
It's not weird at all. It's Thursday at 9.
You're debuting something on the internet. Why do you need a time? Just
because
put it
it's tied into the when Seinfeld aired.
Oh, okay, fine.
It's a cute. It'll be up all week. You don't have to watch it at 9 p.m. It's just they'll make it first available when for a generation he was the biggest show in the world.
Well, that's right, at least according to Nielsen. Now, do you think?
Who else would it be according to?
Well, were you trying to make a joke like it'll be up all week? Like I'm in town all week. Tip your waitress.
No, I wasn't.
Okay,
well, I was gonna make a joke about the PR person for Crackle being called Snap or Pop, but I avoided that.
Okay, I'm sorry, but those are my lines.
Yeah, I know.
And I think you.
See, I actually censor myself. I go, wait, that's not good.
No. And I don't. And except I can never find the cricket button, the button that I'm supposed to press right after I tell a joke.
I think our fans take care of that.
Okay. Well, you know, Nielsen, of course, as you mentioned, when Seinfeld was around, he ruled the Nielsen ratings. And Nielsen bought a music tracking service called SoundScan way back when, and they track music sales and music playback and on the radio.
They bought it or they developed it?
I'm going to go with either. Okay. I have no idea. Well, they have released their mid-year report, which shows that album sales are actually down 3.2%, but digital sales are up 13.8%. So what does that mean, Michael?
It means there's not a lot of music sales.
Okay. Well, yeah. Okay. So album sales, CD and digital, you know, one particular album, all 10 tracks or 11, however many tracks the album is, dropped 3.2%. Now that's to $150.5 million. And that's only based on a year ago, $155.5 million albums sold in the first 6 months of 2011.
You're going to geek out on numbers, aren't you?
Well, no. I mean, you know, we're talking about how physical media is disappearing. Well, CD sales have declined 15.1% this year, at least in the first 6 months. And digital album sales saw a jump of 13.8%. So believe it or not, album sales digitally are on the rise, but physically on the decline. And the decline.
Well, I would assume that would be the case.
Right. And the decline just happened to outpace the physical media had outpaced the increase in digital.
But I mean, already more albums are sold digitally. That's the real news. 57 million albums were sold digitally. 42 million albums were sold physically. And those are just pathetically low numbers compared to, you know, the 80s.
Right. And, you know, individual track download sales, of course, grew 5.6%.
Pretty modestly.
Yeah, 5.6% to 698 million, which is...
So that's just about the equivalent of another 70 million albums, if you figure about 10 tracks an album.
Right. But, you know, who was the big winner here in terms of the artists that were kind of raking it in?
It's still Adele.
I know. I can't believe that. I mean, since that album came out in the U.S., she has sold 9.5 million copies of 21, her album.
And that's a sign of, you know, positive. I mean, people go, oh, no, you know, nothing else is happening. No, their albums are coming around. But, hey, an album can still become an actual blockbuster. I mean, you know, almost 10 million copies. Is this worldwide or is this North America?
North America.
That's a real
domestic hit. Yeah, I mean, look.
That's an old school blockbuster.
Just this year alone, she sold 3.67 million units. So almost a third of those came this year. And, of course, she had a huge evening back in February. She was doing something. What was it again?
She's winning tons of Grammys.
That's right.
But the shocker here is that for the first time since SoundScan began back in 1991, and probably for the first time since the 60s, if not earlier, only one album sold a million copies in the first 6 months of the year. One album, of course, Adele. Nobody else sold a million copies of anything. That's unbelievable. That's how moribund album sales are. And I should know because I was out in the suburbs. I was in Alabama. I was going to malls or going, you know, in Allentown, Pennsylvania, visiting with my brother and his family, going into Walmart and the few places left where you can buy music. Just seeing what they had available and what was there. The floor space was so pathetically small. The selection was so pathetic. You know, I would think about 8 or 10 big new releases. A pretty big artist couldn't find any of them. One copy of Bruce Springsteen, Wrecking Ball. That was it. You know, just
that's
awful.
Because
you can't
all the
buy music even if you want.
That's because all the other copies had already been sold because Springsteen rules.
That's right. The second best selling album of the year, however, is not Bruce Springsteen. He's not even in the top five. It's Lionel Richie with his album Tuskegee, which was a crossover album where he went with some of the big country artists and re-recorded some of his biggest hits in the country style. That sold 900,000 copies, almost a million. And in this day and age, that makes it a big hit. Right below that is One Direction, the boy band I talked about, who have a concert film opening up in November. That sold almost 900,000 copies. Below that, Whitney Houston. Of course, she died tragically, and her greatest hits album jumped back onto the charts. She sold another 800,000 copies of that album. And then at number five was a various artist compilation, Now 41, a long-running series that began in the UK, and that sold 700,000 copies. But this week, pretty good numbers. This week, the number one album in the country is Linkin Park. They have a new number one album, debuted there, 223,000 copies, just edging out Maroon 5. And of course, the leader of Maroon 5 is on The Voice, the NBC talent competition, and they had 222,000 copies. So Justin Bieber fell to number three, but this is the fifth number one album for Linkin Park that's happened since their first debut in 2000. No other band has more number one albums in the past 12 years. They are it, baby. Linkin Park is the biggest band in the world, I guess.
Which is shocking to say, but I guess it's a big deal.
It is.
Okay, well, that was my lame way of moving us into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story? Charlie Sheen shouldn't break out the bubbly just yet. His new sitcom, Anger Management, dropped 40% in the ratings in its second week. It was watched by 3.7 million viewers. Still very good numbers, by the way, for a Thursday at 9:30 p.m. on the FX channel. No word on how that affected Wilfred, that show we were talking about earlier, that half-hour, one-camera comedy that stars Elijah Wood, or how it affected Louis and the Russell Brand talk show that followed it. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's what you would expect, that, you know, you have a big debut with a lot of attention. Shows tend to drop. 40% is a big drop. But what you want to see is where it is to week three and four. And, of course, that's what matters as far as whether they get a renewal. Doesn't matter how big you start. They don't even start counting the numbers until week three. And then it has to maintain an audience and not keep dropping. So even if it had big numbers, if it dropped every week, they would have an out that way. Or if the numbers get too low, a certain level, that's another way they say it's not worth our time. But I imagine it'll stabilize soon. You know, we'll have to see. And but it's nothing to be worried about.
Hey, ladies, Tom Cruise is back on the market and more valuable than ever. That's right. You know, what a busy week this guy had. Forbes lists the now 50-year-old. That's right. He turned 50 last week during, I guess, a little
agita.
Yeah, a little agita. Well, so he's now 50, and they listed Forbes listed him as the highest-paid actor in Hollywood for the 12 months from May 2011 to May 2012. It estimates Cruise pulled in, you know, a modest $76 million compared to the $37 million of runners-up Leonardo DiCaprio and Adam Sandler. Next year, let's look for maybe Robert Downey Jr., as you mentioned before, to rank high thanks to his profit participation in a little movie called The Avengers. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. You know, if you listen to our show, we had said people who dismissed him and said he was washed up, you know, they've said it a number of times in his career, and it seemed foolish. And if you looked at his actual numbers, he's rarely stumbled for very long. And we had every reason to think he'd be back on top, and he is. So, you know, it's nice to be proven right. And of course, he had a, you know, big divorce news. They seem to have reached an agreement with Katie Holmes and him. It's the quickest divorce settlement in history, practically, especially for a couple this prominent. There's no word yet on the details of the divorce. Neither side is talking, though we have to assume she has primary custody of Suri or they'd be going to court.
Well, yeah, we're not really going to get into that, are we?
No.
Okay. Well, then maybe let's move on. Best-selling sci-fi author John Scalzi and his publisher Tor are taking a page from Charles Dickens. And by the way, almost every other author who published big books back in Dickens' time, they'll be publishing Scalzi's new novel, The Human Division, as a 12-part ebook serial beginning in December of 2012 and ending in February 2013, followed by a hardcover and complete ebook in late spring or summer. Because everyone wants to be HBO, even in publishing, they compared the project not to Dickens and other masters of the serialized form that exist in books, but to a TV drama with 12 episodes, because that makes sense somehow. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. It's a nice, smart variation on the thing. The book is done, so it's not like he's going to be writing every week like a genuine serial, like Tales of the City was done for Armistead Maupin did for newspapers. The only thing I don't like is that in the details they mentioned that at the end, they expect to make buying the ebook in 12 parts as a serial to be about the same price as the hardcover and final ebook version. That's fine. That makes sense. But then he added, there'd probably be some additional material in the final hardcover and ebook. I'm like, well, why are you penalizing me for buying it as a serial? If in fact there's going to be a final version with new information, new additional detail, you should either, you should make that available as a download to the ebook people because they're comfortable with ebooks, or you should include that information in the serial. You know, do not penalize people for being there early on your product.
Well, yeah, I think that's, again, taking a page from the television / you know, home video world, where it's, you know, it's basically they're trying to make you buy it all over again. So yes, you watched all three Star Wars, but now buy the box set because it has, you know, 2 more hours of exclusive footage. Well, you know,
well, I think the comparison there is to like a series that, say, maybe an old series that's already, you know, available for a long time. And then they put out each season. And then at the end, they put out a box set with every season available plus bonus extras. And you say, well, hell, for the last 3 years, I've been buying each season. Why do I, you know, am I supposed to buy the box set all over again just to get that extra, you know, half hour documentary? That doesn't seem fair. What you should do is, when available, when possible, make everything available to the fans up front. Or in this case, since you're doing it as a serial version, when you do finish the final product, give them the extra material. They shouldn't be penalized for, you know, supporting your release.
I couldn't agree more. I think you're absolutely right. And I think the way that it's being structured by including extra material in the full release and the complete ebook, and not providing that to those who may be subscribed to the serialized version is old thinking.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of old, Kelly Ripa, who is not old. She's not old, but
no.
but the show is, I guess.
Yes.
You know, she is still searching for a new co-host to replace Regis Philbin.
No one can replace Regis.
Well, I guess technically you could say Regis Philbin is old, but let's not go there. You know, here's the thing, though. With ratings up slightly and loads of stars clamoring to share the chair with Kelly Ripa, she's in no hurry. That means lots of speculation about who the lucky winner will be, who's going to get
it. It's been 18 months.
I know. Well, with Seth Meyers returning for another week-long stint, naturally people are wondering if the show would like to go younger and cast the Saturday Night Live star as the snarky kid brother to Ripa. Other potential candidates include singers Josh Groban and Michael Bublé, who is also on The Voice this season as a song coach, by the way, former NFLer Michael Strahan, and of course, because you have to include him in just about everything you say, Neil Patrick Harris as the gay best pal. Myers is a key fixture on SNL and has been with the show since 2001, longer than anyone else in front of the camera. So the greener pastures of daytime might actually look appealing for his second act. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop that, you know, somebody's trying to promote him as a front runner. I don't know if that's clear. He's still very involved in SNL. He's a producer on the show. They were just doing auditions. They need to hire some new people. And in February, they had a round of live auditions in front of Lorne Michaels. And he was one of the, you know, 3 or 4 big people who were there watching the new people to help pass judgment and decide whether they should be brought into the cast. So he's still very much active on that show, but hey, it's been 11 years or something like that. So, you know, this could be a good fit for him. Whether they want him is another question.
Hey, Michael, can you say cover up?
Yes, cover up.
Okay, well, a down and dirty documentary financed by the father of the late Dodi Al-Fayed. It has collapsed right before it was scheduled to hit theaters on the 15th anniversary of the death of Al-Fayed and Diana, Princess of Wales. Why, you might ask, or maybe you didn't, I'm not sure, because I didn't give you time. Because producers on the film simply could not indemnify themselves and distributors against potential lawsuits. Even though the film wasn't set to be released in the UK and France, it proved impossible to find an insurer willing to cover those two countries. The most likely places were where a lawsuit might be filed for various legal reasons. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Oh, big whoop, I think, though. Wasn't it at Cannes? It wasn't in the market there or something?
Yeah, that... I think, Stephen Garrett, our contemporary,
yes,
saw it, yes. And he said, you know. The big thing was that it had an unpublished photograph of the scene where Princess Diana.
Right, that was the grisly killed thing. But I think he said there were some interesting things in it. But, you know, my feeling is always that if you look into where we went to lunch and what we had, you can find inconsistencies and conflicting reports. And, you know, when it's something this big, there's always things that if you want to go and you can go, oh my God, it's confusing. It's a cover up. Why was that woman there when she's never there? You know, so I don't put much weight behind elaborate conspiracy theories, but it's interesting that they couldn't get it indemnified, that was the problem. I can't remember the last film where that was the case. I wonder why. I mean, you know, the royal family and the Spencers aren't going to sue.
No, no, no.
So who exactly are they worried about?
Probably
the government or government. I mean, again, they wouldn't sue. It just is a strange thing, unless they're naming some particular individual as the culprit.
The driver of the car?
Huh?
The driver of the car?
Well, he's dead, isn't he?
Yes, but his family isn't.
Oh, but I mean, no, that was the whole point. The official explanation was that the driver of the car was at fault, and they're saying it wasn't the driver of the car. So his family would applaud him.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Oh, but thank you for saying Diana, Princess of Wales, not Princess Diana. My mother, if she's listening, will be very happy because that's her proper title. At least it was at the time.
That's very true. Now, this is a follow-up story, Michael. Do you remember the ferocious lawsuit between many of the cast members of the hit sitcom Happy Days and CBS?
Yes.
Well, everyone is all smiles again as the cast members drop their lawsuit in exchange for a drumroll. Oh, drum roll. Thank you very much. Can you do a cricket sound by any chance?
No, I can't.
Okay. Well, some $65,000 each to Mr. and Mrs. Cunningham, Joni, Ralph Mouth, and Potsy. Or to be exact, the wife of Tom Bosley, who played Mr. C. That's a lot of money if you can go back in time to 1955 to spend it. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I have to say big whoop. I mean, that is such a piddling amount of money for, you know, royalties assigned to their likenesses and all the things and all the merchandising that's been going on. They haven't seen a check since 1980 or something like that. I guess the heyday of Happy Days was gone, and they finally decided when they looked in the books or the numbers that they didn't have that much money coming to them. It still seems awfully low.
Well, you know, actually the judgment was for $2.65 million, but the rest went to lawyers and accountants. So
$2 million went to lawyers and $400,000 went to them? That seems a high take by the lawyers.
Well, I can't believe you took me seriously. The whole thing was a joke.
Oh, well, I mean, they did have to, this money does not, is includes money. The lawyers get a cut of this money.
That's right.
How small it is.
That's right. Yeah. Now, speaking of money and lawsuits, Raging Bull 2, it sounds like a joke. I know, Michael, but the Raging Bull, the musical, by the way, probably would be a tad funnier. But to MGM, who does musicals, by the way, it's no laughing matter. The studio has filed a suit to stop production on the indie film, insisting they had right of first refusal on any future biographical works by boxer Jake LaMotta, who, of course, was the subject of Raging Bull, and that the new movie, Raging Bull 2, would damage the value of the original movie, Raging Bull, the Oscar-winning film widely considered an all-time classic. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things. It sounds like this low rent straight to video. You're like, what is this Raging Bull 2? And I look up the director. I've never heard of him or any movie he's made. But then you look at the cast listing, and it's actually pretty darn impressive. William Forsythe has the unenviable role of tackling the Jake LaMotta, made famous by Robert De Niro and winning the Oscar for it. But there's also Joe Mantegna, Paul Sorvino, Natasha Henstridge, Penelope Ann Miller, Tom Sizemore, Bruce Davison, Cloris Leachman. I mean, they have, you know, they're not stars who are drawing big bucks or whatever, but that's a respectable cast, I have to say, for what I thought was going to be some sort of a joke of a movie.
Yeah, I can't believe that they would do. I mean, it's almost sacral. It's like Casablanca too. Really?
He wrote another memoir. It seems like it's an awful idea, obviously, but he wrote a memoir about the rest of his life, and, you know.
But the interesting part where he was a boxer, that part was already
done.
Hey, we're going to record a podcast next week. Who wants to send us $50,000 so we can do it? Okay, that's not going to happen, but a number of pop stars with actual name recognition have used Kickstarter and similar sites to get fans to finance the recording of a new album in exchange for exclusive demos, albums, CDs, and the like. The latest is a lesser-known UK artist called Ginger Wildheart, a.k.a. David Walls. He raised $250,000 to record his latest album, and at the end of June, it briefly topped the midweek charts, quote-unquote, a peek at what's selling well, but not the quote-unquote official charts, in the UK. It was immediately hailed as a paradigm shift in music by techies who don't know anything about music, but we want to know, Michael. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. I think it was Tech Dirt that had a story about this. And like, oh my God, he sold more copies than Rihanna and Coldplay. And, you know, this is the way it is. And why don't people realize how great this is for artists? Like, yeah, you know what? When we look at the charts 1 week later, I couldn't find 2 weeks ago, but 1 week later, the album's not even in the top 40. So I don't know where, if it even made it into the charts for a day or two, it sold more copies than other albums, but it didn't maintain it for a week or certainly not for 2 weeks. So this is not a new way of breaking artists. And if you look at the history of Wild Heart, Ginger Wild Heart, he had a band in the 90s called the Wild Hearts. They were on East West, which was a big indie label at the time, probably had major distribution. So like a lot of artists who were able to use Kickstarter, he gained his name recognition with labels and the publicity and all the promotion. And then, you know, now he's trading on that quite legitimately. With he's got a fan base built up by that major label world, and he's using that fan base to sort of, you know, record a new album. That's great. You know, that's those are the people who can do it. People who have the, you know, if you're an author and you become a bestseller thanks to Simon & Schuster, it's a little easier for you to go solo. There are people who break through without that initial platform of a big distributor, but that obviously really helps. So a guy who had that name recognition, had the fan base from the 90s, used it to, you know, fund a new album. Terrific for him. But he has not turned it into a big blockbuster hit.
Kind of like Amanda Palmer or Louis C.K.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, Louis C.K. has got a hit TV show on right now. He's got much more visibility than right. Ginger Wildheart did. So, you know, more credit to him. But it would be great if it had was a good album and had turned into an actual hit. It doesn't seem to have stayed on the chart for even a week, much less two. But it's not a. They haven't reinvented the wheel.
Well, hey, Michael, you have season tickets to the Yankees, don't you?
Yes, I do.
So you're a big baseball fan.
I certainly am.
And baseball on TV is one of the few bright spots in the ratings. And with the fragmentation of viewers, major sports that can grab a chunk of viewers become more and more valuable, as you know. So expect a battle royale this summer now that Fox, ESPN, and Turner all failed to re-sign and re-up with Major League Baseball during their exclusive negotiating windows. Now anyone can make a bid, and NBC is coming in hard. Why? Because sports are guaranteed ratings, and clearly NBC has failed at turning out hit dramas and sitcoms, that's for sure. We've talked about that. But it's not even the major network NBC wants to rejuvenate. In fact, it's their moribund NBC Sports Channel. We kind of talked about it a little bit here on the show about why they're launching that. That network, NBC Sports Channel, used to be the home of the professional bull riding tour and is now mostly quiet and, well, I guess you could say desperate for programming. ESPN beat out NBC for Wimbledon TV rights, but NBC has spent big on hockey and the Olympics to the tune of more than $6 billion in commitments. And of course, Sunday Night Football is almost the only good news on NBC's primetime schedule other than music competition show The Voice. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
So this is very complicated. Basically, you've got three or four channels that own rights to certain games of baseball, like a Monday night baseball game and a Friday night and a Saturday night baseball game and, you know, scattered games throughout the season. A lot of baseball is owned locally. So the YES Network, which the Yankees own, that's a $1 billion property because they show like well over half of all games are shown on the YES Network. So locally is where baseball thrives. But the major networks and these channels can cherry pick some big games, some big lineups. We just had the last game of the first half of the season was the New York Yankees versus Boston on ESPN, which was promoting and leading into ESPN having the home run derby and the All-Star game. So these are very valuable, pro television. And, you know, everybody wants a piece of it. Fox, ESPN, and Turner paying through the nose for these shows. NBC is coming in. They're going to drive up the price of it. So if you're a fan trying to figure out where your channel is and who's got it, it gets very complicated. You know, used to watch Wimbledon every year, you know, on Breakfast with Wimbledon. Well, those days are gone. Now it's on ESPN. My favorite commentator, Mary Carrillo, wasn't even involved in the programming this year because she's not involved in the channel that owns the rights anymore. She's not a player on ESPN. Other channels, you know, Bob Costas, one of the best sports programmers around, he has nothing to do with NBC. He's probably dying for them to get baseball because he's sitting around waiting for the Olympics every 2 years. That's all he gets to do. So when you're a fan, this affects you because if you like baseball and you want to watch these games, suddenly you're going to have to search out the NBC Sports Channel, which, believe me, you don't know where it is on your dial. For me, it's like 468 or something in my dial, nowhere near all the other sports channels. It gets to be a pain in the neck trying to figure out where this programming is located. When you're looking at Wimbledon, you've got it on the Tennis Channel and ESPN and going back and forth between them and the other channels and trying to figure out what's on when and when the coverage is going to skip. Will it go back to ESPN or will it be on ESPN2 or will it be on the Tennis Channel? I ended up taping like three or four channels all day long just trying to be able to watch Wimbledon. It gets to be a real pain in the neck. So this is going to affect people in a real way because if you're a baseball fan, just figuring out where your game is located gets to be kind of hard.
I know where my games are located.
Where's that?
Dodger Stadium.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that this doesn't even include digital rights. And that's a huge thing for baseball because Major League Baseball has a great app where they show stuff online, and baseball would love to sell. You know, they want to protect their digital rights because, you know, like if you're a fan, you can buy a pass to watch every game of every team except your local team on your iPad app. So if you're a crazy baseball nut, you can watch every game on your iPad without having to go to television.
Or,
you know,
or through Roku, or through your Apple TV, or through, I believe, even TiVo now. I mean, yeah, they are a pioneer when it comes to digital. And I have to say, I have Sirius XM.
It's on, the baseball is on there.
Yes, but if you stream it online, if you get the online package, it is not on there. It is not, you can't stream it through your Sonos or any of your, you know, Rokus or anything like that. The audio.
Oh, yeah. The nice thing is when they let you choose whether you want the home or away team's audio. I like that.
Yes, that's pretty
neat. But the digital rights are handled separately. So that is a huge area of profit that Major League Baseball has been very good at exploiting. Plus, of course, they're protecting their local channels, which are where a huge source of income for Major League Baseball. So this is big news, makes it harder for fans. It's interesting how it's going to spell out. The answer is obvious right now. Bigger tickets, bigger money for Major League Baseball. NBC is going to drive up the price.
Beats Electronics, the company created by Dr. Dre and producer Jimmy Iovine, and best known probably for its headphones, has acquired the struggling music subscription service Moog for a bargain basement reported $10 million. That means the investors of Moog probably took a serious hit since they spent, $10 million. They spent $24 million. That means they lost $14 million. So
I'm no accountant, but that sounds bad.
Yeah. After all the money, Moog is way behind Rhapsody and Spotify and Pandora. Currently, Moog says it has, or, you know, I guess the latest public numbers that it released, they say they had 160,000 monthly users, which includes both paid and free subscribers. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop, or it's a big deal in the sense that it's a misstep for Beats Electronics. I'm not quite sure. They created this company, Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine. They had huge success with the headphones. They've expanded to all sorts of audio, including stereo equipment and car radio systems and all that stuff. It's sort of like Dolby. They want to give the Dr. Dre stamp of approval to your audio equipment so that you'll have, you know, they say, hey man, this is up to our standards.
That's why they call it branding.
But Moog doesn't seem to fit in there to me. I understand it's a streaming service and that, you know, you can have certain levels of quality, but it just doesn't seem to have the same need for that stamp of approval. And it's such a weak service. I wouldn't pay anything for it. I mean, I would have done a partnership with somebody else, but I just don't see,
I can tell you why they did this. They did this because Beats themselves, Beats Audio, was sold to HTC, which is the hardware manufacturing company, the mostly known for phones. And HTC wants to have this service, and they decided to do it in a way, to purchase it in a way that gives the credit to Beats Audio because it's, you know, those two services are complementary. You've got Beats Audio with Dr. Dre.
But Dre and Iovine are still in charge, aren't they? I know HTC, did they buy them or did they invest in them?
I think they bought Beats.
$300 million.
Yeah, and I think they pretty much bought Beats in August of 2011.
But so did Dre and Iovine cash out? Are they gone?
No. They're still a part of it. I mean, when you're buying something like Beats by Dr. Dre, you darn well better keep Dr. Dre around.
That's right. So I don't see it though. I don't get it. I don't see how it works. I guess it's all music, so what's the big deal? But I mean, how are you going to turn Moog around? Why would you want to buy Moog?
I couldn't agree more. I mean,
why would you want to buy Spin Magazine? Spin Magazine has just been sold to a company that owns Stereo Gum and other online websites that are related to music. The fate of the print edition is unclear. They say they know print's important. Spin went to, like, you know, bi-monthly every 2 months just a little while ago. Whether they're going to survive in any format, I don't know. I mean, they paid money for them. I guess they think there's still value in Spin online, but I certainly wouldn't have paid very much for it.
Well, I haven't read Spin Magazine in who knows how long, but in any case, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And you might recall at the top of the show, we talked about how, the fight against
piracy is sort of failing legislatively in Europe.
And actually, even in the United States, because last week, let's start there, Europe rejected ACTA, which is the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. Now, this was supposed to be a a piece of legislation that put everybody, all the countries in the world, on the same page when it came to...
Well, in the EU. Not well, in the world.
No. It was, you know, it was international. It just so happens that the EU shot it down, that it was in the EU to be voted on that particular, during this particular time period, and it was shot down there, which means other countries who have already passed it, I think Singapore is one of the countries that passed it, the US passed it, they're, you know, in the end, it's not going to be adopted in the EU, so what's the point? The whole idea was that it would create a new governing body that would...
It was a new way to fight piracy. They're going to have a new group overseeing, setting out framework and a legal framework and helping countries coordinate their attacks against pirates.
But not just intellectual property piracy, but the counterfeiting of goods like Rolex and, you know, Yves Saint Laurent bags and Louis Vuitton bags. So it was both retail, manufacturing, and intellectual property. And, you know, SOPA really woke everybody up to this, and everybody kind of was up in arms here in January over SOPA. Well, the same thing happened in the EU. People are now kind of a little bit more educated about it, and they crushed it.
Why do we know why it died, or why do you think it died?
Because of the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, and the RIAA are both, they are huge lobbyists for ACTA and for intellectual property protection and for copyright protection, and people and unfortunately, what they want isn't necessarily good for other countries or other industries,
or even for them. Really, what Hollywood tends to do is to try and push some punitive technological fix to try and put the genie back in the bottle. It ends up never working. They're like, well, what if we make CDs unplayable? You know, they end up doing stuff that just punishes regular consumers and doesn't really hurt pirates. And it just annoys everybody. And it's not very effective. They're sort of trying to lock the barn door after the cows got out, you know, that sort of thing.
Right. And so ACTA was dying over in Europe. And the day before the European Parliament shot it down, 478 against to 39 in favor of ACTA.
Ouch.
Yeah, that was kind of a...
That's some bad lobbying.
Yeah, exactly. Here in the U.S., the U.S. Trade Representative, USTR, while negotiating or attending meetings for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is another version of this, but mostly for PAC-RIM countries like Japan and the U.S. and Australia, they...
Is U.S. a PAC-RIM country?
Well, yeah, believe it or not.
Because of Hawaii?
I guess in part because of that, yes. But they're a part of this whole thing. They actually said that they are recognizing the importance of quote unquote limitations and exceptions. Now, what are limitations and exceptions when it comes to copyright? Those are things like fair use. So the fact that we can run a clip on this show of a copyrighted piece of material, but then just give attribution, basically. That was from Jerry Seinfeld's show or whatever. First sale doctrine, meaning, Michael, if you buy a DVD and then want to sell it, you can.
Which I do not have for ebooks at the moment, or at least so they claim.
Correct. So this is huge because the USTR has never, ever...
Legally recognized fair use and first sale doctrine.
Correct, yes.
And because they're stupid.
Now, this one particular person, Harold Field, who was a senior vice president of public knowledge, a Washington, D.C. advocacy group dedicated to the quote-unquote openness of the internet and the public's access to knowledge... He tried to explain how important this was in one of his posts, and he said, for the USTR to publicly embrace limitations and exceptions is as, quote, an important part of the copyright ecosystem is the equivalent of the Pope saying, in some cases, birth control is a good thing because it allows married couples to have sex without procreation, deepening their emotional bond with one another. So, I mean, he was saying... trying to point out.
It's a massive shift in policy.
It's a massive shift in policy. And effectively, what he was saying, what many people are saying is, okay, so ACTA being struck down, not that big a deal. The MPAA, the RIAA, they're going to continue their lobbying efforts with individual countries. They'll just have to continue doing that as opposed to having ACTA to wave around. But that what's good for the U.S. isn't necessarily good for other countries and when it comes to copyright. And that we shouldn't be trying to tighten copyright policy in other countries or even our own. The U.S. Trade Representative has now said that. And that sometimes by tightening copyright policy in a bill and in legislation that also contains legislation for manufacturing and retail and other industries, you actually spoil the whole soup.
Well, that's all getting very complicated. The fact is that people who opposed ACTA would have supported what happened as far as the trade group recognizing that first sale and fair use are valid legal, you know, exceptions. And more importantly, that copyright protection or extending copyright is not the same as fighting piracy. You can be, you know, pro-loosening of copyright and still want to fight piracy. There's separate issues.
That is right.
You know, piracy is piracy. You don't need to change anything in copyright law to acknowledge that, you know, a company in, Angola has no right to make massive copies of box sets of, you know, Bruce Springsteen albums and sell them on their own. You know, it's just
there's
so it's
a
not
company,
that complicated.
There is a company in Angola making massive copies of box sets.
Apparently. So there's a sort of two steps. It sounds like two steps forward for the people who not are pro piracy, but people who want sensible and reasonable ways to approach the problem. People who say, hey, you've got to acknowledge fair use. You've got to acknowledge the first sale doctrine. You can't do these three strikes and you're outlaws where, you know, the Hollywood was kept trying to push the idea that if somebody in Europe or anywhere was found guilty of three acts of piracy, then they'd be banned from the internet forever.
Right.
So which is like saying you never get to drive a car again. That's an obviously wildly extreme step that you would almost never want to take except in massively unusual circumstances.
Right.
And, a college student downloading an album, it doesn't seem an appropriate punishment. So it's a complicated thing. What does it mean for here people here in North America?
Not much right now since the DMCA still rules. So,
but in Canada, they did go along with what Hollywood would like and passed for after more than a decade of lobbying.
15 years, in fact.
A new copyright law that strengthens their laws against combating digital piracy and giving Hollywood some of the things that they lost on ACTA.
Yes. And you know what? Actually, this was very important because you could go into a movie theater and film a movie, you know, film the screen, and it wasn't against the law. So now it is.
Huh. Interesting.
You know, we'll have links to some other resources in our show notes if you want to read up on ACTA and the Trans-Pacific Pact that's being negotiated now. But in the meantime, if you'd like to write us, our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's what Robert from Chicago did last week. He sent us a link to follow up last week's story on Louis C.K.'s plans to sell tickets to his tour without going through Ticketmaster. And he says he's doing 67 shows on this tour. This was a link from Laughspin. So he's doing 67 shows, and they've sold 135,600 tickets to those shows after 1 week on sale. And he's doing two shows that are, I guess, in traditional Ticketmaster venues. And those two shows, they sold 4,400 tickets, or there were 4,400 tickets available. 1,100 tickets are available on StubHub. So 25% of those.
Right. He's saying, look, when you compare what I'm doing on my own and what I do when I'm working with Ticketmaster, whatever the agency might be, the difference is stark. 25% of the tickets made available for those two shows
are available on
StubHub. So scalpers are reselling those tickets and presumably at higher prices, and those shows aren't even sold out yet. On the other hand, for the other 136,000 shows, there are only about 500 tickets available on all scalper sites, including StubHub. So far less than 1% are available to scalpers. So fans are buying the tickets. Fans are holding on to them. Fans are able to use them and go see the show, as opposed to through traditional outlets where he's found one out of every four tickets is available on StubHub or some other site like that. So clearly, if he's fighting piracy, it's a lot of effort, but it's working.
Yes, and thank you for unwinding what I was trying to say there. It's 135,000 tickets, not shows. So
yes,
500 tickets out of 135,000. That's actually pretty darn good, in my opinion.
Right. Virtually nothing is being resold by scalpers from the shows he's doing on his own. And a massive number of them are being resold by scalpers for the two small shows that he's doing through a traditional outlet.
That is
true. So that's pretty telling.
Now, again, the email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or Stitcher or your favorite podcast catcher or an RSS feed, or we can send you an email every time we post another episode. All of that information, as well as ways to follow us, we're on Twitter, where our username is ShowbizSandbox, or we have a Facebook page where our Username is also ShowbizSandbox. It's facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. All that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find links to all of the stories that we've discussed on today's show. Again, that website is showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. It is
michaelgiltz.com.
And that's where some of his writing can be found. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And until next week, play nice.